paralysis. Knock it off, Kitty, she said.
Do you eat them? Kitty asked the general. Or do you leave them out so the vultures can do it?
Shut up, Kitty, Dolly said more loudly. Stop playing games.
The general spoke harshly to Ark, who turned to Dolly. His smooth forehead was visibly moist.
The general is becoming angry, Miss Peel, he said.
And there was the code. Dolly read it clearly. She went to Kitty and seized her tanned arm. She leaned close to Kitty's face.
If you keep this up, Dolly said softly, we will all die.
But one glance into Kitty's fervid, self-annihilating eyes told her it was hopeless. Kitty couldn't stop.
Oops, she said loudly, in mock surprise. Was I not supposed to bring up the genocide?
Here was a word the general knew. He flung himself away from Kitty as if she were on fire, commanding his soldiers in a strangled voice. They shoved Dolly away, knocking her to the ground. When she looked back at Kitty, the soldiers had contracted around her, and the actress was obscured from view. Lulu was shouting, trying to drag Dolly onto her feet.
Mommy, do something! Do something! Make them stop!
Ark,
Dolly called, but Ark was lost to her now. He'd taken his place beside the general, who was screaming with rage. The soldiers were carrying Kitty. Dolly had an impression of kicking from within their midst. She could still hear Kitty's high-reaching voice.
Do you drink their blood, or just use it to mop up your floors? Do you wear their teeth on a string?
There was the sound of a blow, then a scream. Dolly jumped to her feet. But Kitty was gone. The soldiers carried her inside a structure hidden in the trees beside the landing pad. The general and Ark followed them in and shut the door. The jungle was eerily silent, just parrot calls and Lulu's sobs. While the general raged, Ark had whispered orders to two soldiers, and as soon as the general was out of sight, they hustled Dolly and Lulu down the hill, through the jungle, and back to the cars. The drivers were waiting, smoking cigarettes. During the ride, Lulu lay with her head in Dolly's lap, crying as they sped back through the jungle, and then the desert. Dolly rubbed her daughter's soft hair, wondering numbly if they were being taken to prison. But eventually, as the sun leaked toward the horizon, they found themselves at the airport. The general's plane was waiting. By then, Lulu had sat up and moved across the seat. Lulu slept hard during the flight, clutching her Kate Spade book bag. But Dolly didn't sleep. She stared straight ahead at Kitty's empty seat. In the dark of early morning, they took a taxi from Kennedy to Hell's Kitchen. Neither of them spoke. Dolly was amazed to find their building intact, the apartment still at the top of the stairs, the keys in her purse. Lulu went straight to her room and shut the door. Dolly sat in her office, addled from lack of sleep, and tried to organize her thoughts. Should she start with the embassy? Congress? How long would it take to get someone on the phone who could actually help her? And what exactly would she say? Lulu emerged from her room in her school uniform, hair brushed. Dolly hadn't even noticed it was light out. Lulu looked askance at her mother, still in yesterday's clothes, and said,
It's time to go.
You're going to school?
Of course I'm going to school. What else would I do?
They took the subway. The silence between them had become inviolable. Dolly feared it would never end. Watching Lulu's wan, pinched face, she felt a cold wave of conviction. If Kitty Jackson died, her daughter would be lost to her. At their corner, Lulu turned without saying goodbye. Shopkeepers were lifting their metal gates on Lexington Avenue. Dolly bought a cup of coffee and drank it on the corner. She wanted to be near Lulu. She decided to wait on that corner until her daughter's school day had ended. 5.5 more hours. Meanwhile, she would make calls on her cell phone. But Dolly was distracted by thoughts of Kitty in the green dress, oil burns winking on her arms, then her own obscene pride, thinking she'd tamed the general and made the world a better place. The phone was idle in her hand. These were not the sorts of calls she knew how to make. When the gate behind her shuttered up, Dolly saw that it was a photo print shop. The hidden camera was still inside her purse. It was something to do. She went in, handed it over, and asked for prints and a CD of everything they could download. She was still standing outside the shop an hour later when the guy came out with her pictures. By then, she'd made a few calls about Kitty, but no one seemed to take her seriously. Who could blame them? Dolly thought.
These shots. Did you use Photoshop or what?
The guy asked.
They look like totally real.
They are real, she said. I took them myself. The guy laughed.
Come on,
he said, and Dolly felt a shudder deep in her brain. As Lulu had said this morning, what else would I do? She rushed back home and called her old contacts at the Inquirer and the Star, a few of whom were still there. Let the news trickle up. This had worked for Dolly before. Minutes later, she was emailing images. Within a couple of hours, pictures of General B nuzzling Kitty Jackson were being posted and traded on the web. By nightfall, reporters from the major papers around the world had started calling. They called the general, too, whose human relations captain emphatically denied the rumors. That night, while Lulu did homework in her room, Dolly ate cold sesame noodles and set out to reach Ark. It took 14 tries.
We can no longer speak, Miss Peel,
he said.
Ark, we cannot speak. The general is angry.
Listen to me.
The general is angry, Miss Peel.
Is she alive, Ark? That's all I need to know.
She is alive.
Thank you. Tears filled Dolly's eyes. Are they treating her okay?
She is unharmed, Miss Peel,
Ark said.
We will not speak again.
They were silent, listening to the hum of the overseas connection.
It is a pity,
Ark said, and hung up. But Dolly and Ark did speak again. Months later, a year almost, when the general came to New York to speak at the UN about his country's transition to democracy. Dolly and Lulu had moved away from the city by then, but one evening they drove into Manhattan to meet Ark at a restaurant. He wore a black suit and a wine-colored tie that matched the excellent Cabernet he poured for himself and Dolly. He seemed to savor telling the story, as if he'd memorized its details especially for her, how 3 or 4 days after she and Lulu had left the general's redoubt, the photographers began showing up, first one or two whom the soldiers ferreted out of the jungle and imprisoned, then more. Too many to capture or even count. They were superb hiders, crouching like monkeys in the trees, burying themselves in shallow pits, camouflaging inside bunches of leaves. Assassins had never managed to locate the general with any precision, but the photographers made it look easy. Scores of them surging across the borders without visas, curled in baskets and wine casks, rolled up in rugs, juddering over unpaved roads in the backs of trucks, and eventually surrounding the general's enclave, which he didn't dare leave. It took 10 days to persuade the general he had no choice but to face his inquisitors. He donned his military coat with the medals and epaulets, pulled the blue hat over his head, took Kitty's arm, and walked with her into the phalanx of cameras awaiting him. Dolly remembered how perplexed the general had looked in those pictures, newly born in his soft blue hat, unsure how to proceed. Beside him, Kitty was smiling, wearing a black, close-fitting dress that Ark must have gone to some trouble to procure, so apt was it. Casual and intimate, plain yet revealing, the sort of dress a woman wears in private, with her lover. Her eyes were hard to read, but each time Dolly looked at them, rubbing her gaze obsessively over the newsprint, she'd heard Kitty's laugh in her ears.
"Have you seen Miss Jackson's new movie?" Ark asked. "I thought it was her finest yet."
Dolly had seen it. A romantic comedy in which Kitty played a jockey, appearing effortlessly joyful on horseback. Dolly had gone with Lulu at the local theater in the small upstate town where they'd moved shortly after the other generals began to call. First G, then A, then L, and P, and Y. Word had gotten out, and Dolly was deluged with offers of work from mass murderers hungry for a fresh start.
"I'm out of the game," she'd told them, and directed them to her former competitors.
Lulu had opposed the move at first, but Dolly was firm. And Lulu had settled in quickly at the local public school, where she took up soccer and found a new coterie of girls who seemed to follow her everywhere. No one in town had ever heard of LaDolle, so Lulu had nothing to hide. Dolly received a generous lump sum from the general shortly after his rendezvous with the photographers.
"A gift to express our immense gratitude for your invaluable guidance, Miss Peel,"
Ark had said over the telephone, but Dolly had heard his smile and understood. Hush money. She used it to open a small gourmet shop on Main Street, where she sold fine produce and unusual cheeses, artfully displayed and lit by a system of small spotlights Dolly designed herself.
"This feels like Paris," was a comment she often heard from New Yorkers who came on weekends to their country houses.
Now and then, Dolly would get a shipment of starfruit, and she always made sure to put a few aside to eat with Lulu. She would bring them back to the small house they shared at the end of a quiet street. After supper, the radio on, windows open to the yawning night, she and Lulu would feast on the sweet, strange flesh. Chapter 9. 40-Minute Lunch. Kitty Jackson opens up about love, fame, and Nixon. Jules Jones reports.
"Movie stars always look small the first time you see them, and Kitty Jackson is no exception, exceptional though she may be in every other way. Actually, small isn't the word. She's minute, a human bonsai in a white sleeveless dress, seated at a back table of a Madison Avenue restaurant, talking on a cell phone. She smiles at me as I take my seat and rolls her eyes at the phone. Her hair is that blonde you see everywhere, highlighted, my ex-fiancé calls it, though on Kitty Jackson, this tousled commingling of blonde and brown appears both more natural and more costly than it did on Janet Green. Her face, Kitty's, is one you can imagine looking merely pretty among the other faces in, say, a high school classroom. Upturned nose, full mouth, big green eyes. Yet on Kitty Jackson, for reasons I can't pinpoint exactly, the same reasons I suppose that her highlighted hair looks superior to ordinary, Janet Green's highlighted hair, this unexceptional face registers as extraordinary. She's still on the phone, and 5 minutes have passed. Finally, she signs off, folds her phone into a disc the size of an after-dinner mint, and stows it in a small white patent leather purse. Then she starts to apologize. It is instantly clear that Kitty belongs in the category of nice stars, Matt Damon, rather than of difficult stars, Ralph Fiennes. Stars in the nice category act as if they're just like you, i.e., me, so that you will like them and write flattering things about them,
a strategy that is almost universally successful, despite every writer's belief that he's far too jaded to fantasize that the Vanity Fair cover is incidental to Brad Pitt's desire to give him a tour of his house. Kitty is sorry for the 12 flaming hoops I've had to jump through and the several miles of piping hot coals I've sprinted across for the privilege of spending 40 minutes in her company. She's sorry for having just spent the first 6 of those minutes talking to somebody else. Her welter of apologies reminds me of why I prefer difficult stars, the ones who barricade themselves inside their stardom and spit through the cracks. There is something out of control about a star who cannot be nice, and the erosion of a subject's self-control is the sine qua non of celebrity reporting. The waiter takes our order, and since the 10 minutes of badinage I proceed to exchange with Kitty are simply not worth relating, I'll mention instead, in the footnotish fashion that injects a whiff of cracked leather bindings into pop cultural observation, that when you're a young movie star with blondish hair and a highly recognizable face from that recent movie whose grosses can only be explained by the conjecture that every person in America saw it at least twice, people treat you in a manner that is somewhat different, in fact, is entirely different, from the way they treat, say, a balding, stoop-shouldered, slightly eczematous guy approaching middle age. On the surface, it's the same, may I take your order, etc. But throbbing just beneath that surface is the waiter's hysterical recognition of my subject's fame. And with a simultaneity that can only be explained using principles of quantum mechanics, specifically, the properties of so-called entangled particles, that same pulse of recognition reaches every part of the restaurant at once, even tables so distant from ours that there is simply no way they can see us. Footnote 1. I've engaged in a bit of sophistry here, suggesting that entangled particles can explain anything when, to date, they themselves have not been satisfactorily explained. Entangled particles are subatomic twins, photons created by splitting a single photon in half with a crystal, which still react identically to stimuli applied to only one of them, even when separated from each other by many miles. How, puzzled physicists ask, can one particle possibly know what is happening to the other? How, when the people occupying tables nearest to Kitty Jackson inevitably recognize her, do people outside the line of vision of Kitty Jackson, who could not conceivably have had the experience of seeing Kitty Jackson, recognize her simultaneously? Theoretical explanations. 1. The particles are communicating. Impossible. Because they would have to do so at a speed faster than the speed of light, thus violating relativity theory. In other words, in order for an awareness of Kitty's presence to sweep the restaurant simultaneously, the diners at tables nearest to her would have to convey, through words or gestures, the fact of her presence to diners farther away who cannot see her, all at a speed faster than the speed of light. And that is impossible. 2. The two photons are responding to local factors engendered by their former status as a single photon. This was Einstein's explanation for the phenomenon of entangled particles, which he termed spooky action at a distance. Nope. Because we've already established that they're not responding to each other. They're all responding simultaneously to Kitty Jackson, whom only a small fraction of them can actually see. 3. It's one of those quantum mechanical mysteries. Apparently so. All that can be said for sure is that in the presence of Kitty Jackson, the rest of us become entangled by our sheer awareness that we ourselves are not Kitty Jackson, a fact so brusquely unifying that it temporarily wipes out all distinctions between us. Our tendency to cry inexplicably during parades, or the fact that we never learned French, or have a fear of insects that we do our best to conceal from women, or like to eat construction paper as a child. In the presence of Kitty Jackson, we no longer are in possession of these traits. Indeed, so indistinguishable are we from every other non-Kitty Jackson in our vicinity that when one of us sees her, the rest simultaneously react. End of footnote. Everywhere, people are swiveling, craning, straining and contorting, levitating inadvertently from chairs as they grapple with the urge to lunge at Kitty and pluck off tufts of her hair and clothing. I ask Kitty how it feels to always be the center of attention.
Weird, she says. It's so, all of a sudden, you feel like there's no way you deserve it.
See? Nice. Oh, come now, I say, and lob her a compliment on her performance as the homeless junkie turned FBI gunslinger slash acrobat in Oh Baby Oh. The sort of shameless bit of fawning that makes me wonder whether I might prefer death by lethal injection to my present vocation as a celebrity reporter. Wasn't she proud?
I was proud, she says. But in a way, I didn't even know what I was doing yet. With my new movie, I feel more...
Hold that thought, I cry, though the waiter has not yet reached our table, and the tray he bears aloft is probably not even ours. Because I don't want to hear about Kitty's new movie. I couldn't care less, and neither could you, I know. Her prattle about the challenging role and the trusting relationship she had with her director and what an honor it was to work opposite such a seasoned star as Tom Cruise is the bitter pill we both must swallow in exchange for the privilege of spending some collective time in Kitty's company. But let's put it off as long as possible. Luckily, it is our tray. Food arrives faster if you're dining with a star. A Cobb salad for Kitty, a cheeseburger, fries, and Caesar salad for me. A bit of theory as we settle down to lunch. The waiter's treatment of Kitty is actually a kind of sandwich, with the bottom bread being the bored and slightly effete way he normally acts with customers, the middle being the crazed and abnormal way he feels around this famous 19-year-old girl, and the top bread being his attempt to contain and conceal this alien middle layer with some mode of behavior that at least approximates the bottom layer of boredom and effeteness that is his norm. In the same way, Kitty Jackson has some sort of bottom bread that is, presumably, her, or the way Kitty Jackson once behaved in suburban Des Moines where she grew up, rode a bike, attended proms, earned decent grades, and, most intriguingly, jumped horses, thereby winning a substantial number of ribbons and trophies and, at least briefly, entertaining thoughts of becoming a jockey. On top of that is her extraordinary and possibly slightly psychotic reaction to her newfound fame, the middle of the sandwich. And on top of that is her own attempt to approximate layer number one with a simulation of her normal or former self. 16 minutes have passed.
Rumor has it,
I say, my mouth full of half-masticated hamburger in a calculated effort to disgust my subject, thus puncturing her prophylactic shield of niceness and commencing the painstaking attrition of her self-control,
that you've become involved with your co-star.
That gets her attention. I've rather sprung this on her, having learned the hard way that sidling up to the personal questions gives difficult subjects too much time to get their hackles up, and nice ones too much time to gently and blushingly sidestep.
That's absolutely not true, Kitty cries. Tom and I have a wonderful friendship. I love Nicole. She's been a role model for me. I've even babysat their children.
I unsheath my big fat grin, a meaningless tactic intended purely to unnerve and fluster my subject. If my methods seem unnecessarily harsh, I invite you to recall that I have been allotted 40 minutes, nearly 20 of which have now elapsed, and let me add, on a personal note, that if the piece stinks, i.e., if it fails to unveil some aspect of Kitty that you haven't seen before, as have, I'm told, my pieces on hunting elk with Leonardo DiCaprio, reading Homer with Sharon Stone, and digging for clams with Jeremy Irons, it might very well be killed, thus further reducing my stock in New York and Los Angeles, and prolonging the bizarre string of failures you've been having, buddy. Atticus Levi, my friend and editor, over lunch last month.
Why are you smiling like that? Kitty asks, with hostility.
See, no more nice. Was I smiling? She turns her attention to her Cobb salad. And so do I. Because I have so little to go on, so few ports of entry to the inner sanctum of Kitty Jackson, that I'm reduced to observing and now relaying the fact that over the course of lunch, she eats all of her lettuce, approximately 2.5 bites of chicken, and several tomato wedges. She ignores olives, blue cheese, boiled eggs, bacon, and avocado. In other words, all of the parts of the Cobb salad that, technically speaking, make it a Cobb salad. As for the dressing, which she has requested on the side, she doesn't touch it except to dip in the end of her index finger once and suck the dressing off. Footnote 2. Occasionally, life affords you the time, the repose, the dolce far niente, to ask the sorts of questions that go largely unexamined in the brisk course of ordinary life. How well do you recall the mechanics of photosynthesis? Have you ever managed to use the word ontology in a conversational sentence? At what precise moment did you tip just slightly out of alignment with the relatively normal life you had been enjoying theretofore, cant infinitesimally to the left or the right, and thus embark upon the trajectory that ultimately delivered you to your present whereabouts? In my case, Rikers Island Correctional Facility. After several months of subjecting each filament and nanosecond of my lunch with Kitty Jackson to a level of analysis that would make Talmudic scholars look hasty in their appraisal of the Sabbath, I have concluded that my own subtle yet decisive realignment occurred at precisely the moment when Kitty Jackson dipped her finger into the bowl of salad dressing on the side and sucked the dressing off. Here, carefully teased apart and restored to chronological order, is a reconstruction of the brew of thoughts and impulses that I now believe coursed through my mind at that time. Thought 1. At the sight of Kitty dipping her finger and sucking it. Can it possibly be that this ravishing young girl is coming on to me? Thought 2. No, that's out of the question. Thought 3. But why is it out of the question? Thought 4. Because she's a famous 19-year-old movie star, and you're heavier all of a sudden, or am I just noticing it more? Janet Green during our last failed sexual encounter, and have a skin problem and no worldly clout. Thought 5. but she just dipped her finger into a bowl of salad dressing and sucked it off in my presence. What else can that possibly mean? Thought 6. It means you're so far outside the field of Kitty's sexual consideration that her internal sensors, which normally stifle behavior that might be construed as overly encouraging or possibly incendiary, such as dipping a finger into salad dressing and sucking it off in the company of a man who might interpret it as a sign of sexual interest, are not operative. Thought 7. Why not? Thought 8. Because you do not register as a man on Kitty Jackson's radar screen, and so being around you makes her no more self-conscious than would the presence of a dachshund. End of footnote. I'll tell you what I'm thinking, I finally say, relieving the vibrato of tension that has been building at our table. I'm thinking 19 years old. Mega grossing movie behind her, half the world doing a rain dance at her window, and where can she possibly go next? What can she possibly do? In Kitty's face, I see a number of things. Relief that I haven't said something worse, something about Tom Cruise, and mingled with that relief, and partly because of it, a fleeting desire to see me as more than yet another crank with a tape recorder, to see me as someone who understands the incredible strangeness of her world. How I wish it were true! I would like nothing more than to understand the strangeness of Kitty's world, to burrow inside that strangeness, never to emerge. But the best I can hope for is to conceal from Kitty Jackson the bald impossibility of any real communion between us, and the fact that I've managed to do so for 21 minutes is a triumph. Why do I keep mentioning, inserting as it may seem, myself into this story? Because I'm trying to wrest readable material from a 19-year-old girl who is very, very nice. I'm trying to build a story that not only unlocks the velveteen secrets of her teenager's heart, but also contains action, development, along with, God help me, some intimation of meaning. But my problem is this. Kitty's a snooze. The most interesting thing about her is the effect she has upon others, and since the other whose inner life is most readily available for our collective inspection happens to be myself, it is only natural, indeed it is required, I'm begging you, please make this work so I don't look like an asshole for assigning it to you, Atticus Levi, during a recent phone conversation in which I expressed to him my despair of writing further celebrity profiles, that the alleged story of my lunch with Kitty Jackson actually be the story of the myriad effects Kitty Jackson has upon me during the course of said lunch. And for those effects to be remotely comprehensible, you must bear in mind that Janet Green, my girlfriend of 3 years and my fiancé for 1 month and 13 days, dumped me 2 weeks ago for a male memoirist whose recent book details his adolescent penchant for masturbating into the family fish tank. At least he's working on himself, Janet Green, during a recent phone conversation in which I tried to point out what a colossal error she'd made.
I wonder that all the time. What will happen next? Kitty says. Sometimes I imagine myself looking back on right now, and I think, like, where will I be standing when I look back? Will right now look like the beginning of a great life, or what?
And how exactly is a great life defined in Kitty Jackson's lexicon?
Oh, you know.
Giggle. Blush. We're back to nice, but a different nice than before. We've had a tiff, and now we're making up.
Fame and fortune? I prod.
Somewhat, but also just happiness. I want to find true love. I don't care how corny that sounds. I want children. That's why, in this new movie, I bond so strongly with my surrogate mother.
But my Pavlovian efforts to suppress the PR component of our lunch have succeeded, and Kitty falls silent. No sooner have I congratulated myself on this triumph, however, than I catch Kitty glancing sidelong at her watch, Air Maze. How does this gesture affect me? Well, I feel slopping within me a volatile stew of anger, fear, and lust. Anger because this naif has, for reasons that are patently unjustifiable, far more power in the world than I will ever have. And once my 40 minutes are up, nothing short of criminal stalking could force the intersection of my subterranean path with her lofty one. Fear because, having glanced at my own watch, Timex, I've discovered that 30 of those 40 minutes have elapsed, and I have, as yet, no event to form the centerpiece of my profile. Lust, because her neck is very long, with a thin, nearly translucent gold necklace around it. Her shoulders, exposed by the white halter top of her sundress, are small and tan and very delicate, like two little squabs. But that makes them sound unappealing, and they were phenomenally appealing. By squabs, I mean that they looked so good, her shoulders, that I could briefly imagine pulling apart all those little bones and sucking the meat off them one by one. Footnote 3. For those who will inevitably interpret this caprice as further evidence that I am, indeed, a numbnuts, a creepazoid, or a sick puppy, excerpts from correspondence received from strangers while in jail, I can offer only the following. On a spring day almost 4 years ago, I noticed a girl with short, thick legs and a long, narrow torso wearing a pink, tie-dyed t-shirt, picking up dog poop with a Dwayne Reed bag. She was one of those muscly girls who turn out to have been a swimmer or a diver in high school, though I later learned she'd been neither, and her dog was a mangy, wet-looking little terrier of the sort that would seem, even by the most neutral and objective standards, unlovable. But she loved it.
"Here, Whiskers," she cooed. "Come on, girl."
Watching her, I saw it all. The small, overheated apartment strewn with running shoes and leotards, the bi-weekly dinner at her parents'. The soft, dark fuzz on her upper lip that she bleached each week with a tart-smelling white cream. And the feeling I had was not of wanting her so much as being surrounded by her, blundering inside her life without having moved. "May I help you with that?" I asked, stepping into the sunlight where she and Whiskers stood and slipping the Dwayne Reed bag full of poop from her hand. Janet grinned. It was like someone waving a flag.
"Are you insane?" she said.
End of footnote. I asked Kitty how it feels to be a sex goddess.
"It doesn't feel like anything," she says, bored and annoyed. "That's something other people feel."
"Men, you mean?"
"I guess," she says, and a new expression flickers over her comely face and alights there, a look that I would have to designate as abrupt weariness.
I feel it too, abruptly weary. In fact, generally weary. "It's all such a farce," I say, in an unguarded moment of self-expression that has no strategic purpose and which, therefore, I'll doubtless regret within seconds. Why do we bother to participate?
Kitty tilts her head at me. I sense that she can detect my general weariness, possibly even guess at some of its causes. She is regarding me, in other words, with pity. I am now perilously close to succumbing to the single greatest hazard of celebrity reporting, permitting my subject to reverse the beam of scrutiny, at which point I will no longer be able to see her. With a sudden pressure heralded by pricks of sweat along my drastically receding hairline, I swab the bottom of my salad plate with a vast hunk of bread and jam it into my mouth like a dentist packing a tooth. And just then, ah yes, I feel the niggling onset of a sneeze. Here it comes, Hail Mary. Bread or no bread, nothing can halt the shouting simultaneous eruption of every cavity in my head. Kitty looks terrified. She shrinks from me while I sort out the mess. Disaster averted. Or at least, forestalled. You know, I say, when finally I've managed to swallow my bread and blow my nose at the cost of nearly 3 minutes, I'd love to take a walk. What do you say? Kitty springs from her chair at the prospect of escaping into the open air. It's a perfect day, after all, sunlight leaping through the restaurant windows. But her excitement is immediately tempered by an equal and opposite degree of caution.
What about Jake?
She asks, referring to her publicist, who will appear when our 40 minutes are up and wave his hand to turn me back into a pumpkin. Can he just call and meet up with us? I ask.
Okay,
she says, doing her best to simulate the first wave of genuine enthusiasm she felt, despite the middle layer of wariness that has intruded.
Sure, let's go.
I hastily pay the bill. Now, I've orchestrated our debauchment for several reasons. One, I want to filch a few extra minutes off Kitty in an attempt to salvage this assignment and, in a larger sense, my once promising, now dwindling literary reputation. I think she was maybe disappointed that you didn't try writing another novel after the first one didn't sell. Beatrice Green, over hot tea, after I threw myself sobbing upon her Scarsdale doorstep, pleading for insights into her daughter's defection. Two, I want to see Kitty Jackson erect and in motion. To this end, I follow behind as she leads the way out of the restaurant, weaving among tables with her head down in the manner of both exceptionally attractive women and also famous people, not to mention those like Kitty, who are both. Here's a translation of her posture and gait into English. I know I'm famous and irresistible, a combination whose properties closely resemble radioactivity, and I know that you in this room are helpless against me. It's embarrassing for both of us to look at each other and see our mutual knowledge of my radioactivity and your helplessness, so I'll keep my head down and let you watch me in peace. While all this is happening, I'm taking in Kitty's legs, which are long, considering her modest height, as well as brown, and not that orangey brown of tanning salons, but a rich, tawny chestnut that makes me think of, well, of horses. Central Park is one block away. The time elapsed is 41 minutes and counting. We enter the park. It is green and splashy with light and shadow, giving the impression that we've dived together into a deep, still pond.
I forget when we started, Kitty says, looking at her watch. How much more time do we have?
Oh, we're okay, I mumble. I'm feeling kind of dreamy. I'm looking at Kitty's legs as we walk,
as much as I can without crawling beside her on the ground, a thought that crosses my mind, and discovering that above the knee they are flecked with hairs of finest gold. Because Kitty is so young and well-nourished, so sheltered from the gratuitous cruelty of others, so unaware as yet that she will reach middle age and eventually die, possibly alone, because she has not yet disappointed herself, merely startled herself and the world with her own premature accomplishments, Kitty's skin, that smooth, plump, sweetly fragrant sack upon which life scrawls the record of our failures and exhaustion, is perfect. And by perfect, I mean that nothing hangs or sags or snaps or wrinkles or ripples or bunches. I mean that her skin is like the skin of a leaf, except it's not green. I can't imagine such skin having an unpleasant odor or texture or taste, ever being, for example, it is frankly inconceivable, even mildly eczematous. We sit together on a grassy slope. Kitty has resumed talking dutifully about her new movie, the specter of her returning publicist doubtless having reminded her that the promotion of said movie is the sole reason she is in my company. "Oh, Kitty," I say, "forget the movie. We're out here in the park. It's a gorgeous day. Let's leave those other two people behind us. Let's talk about horses." What a look! What a gaze! Every cheesy metaphor you can fathom comes to mind. Sun breaking through clouds, flowers yawning into bloom, the sudden and mystical appearance of a rainbow. It's done. I've reached behind or around or within. I've touched the real Kitty. And for reasons I cannot understand, reasons that surely must rank among the most mysterious of quantum mechanical mysteries, I experience this contact as revelatory, urgent, as if, in bridging the crevasse between myself and this young actress, I am being lifted above an encroaching darkness. Kitty opens her small white purse and takes out a picture. A picture of a horse with a white starburst on its nose. His name is Nixon. "Like the president?" I ask, but Kitty looks disturbingly blank at this reference.
"I just like the sound of that name," she says, and describes the sensation of feeding Nixon an apple, how he takes it between his horsey jaws and smashes it all at once with a cascade of milky, steaming juice. "I hardly ever get to see him," she says, with genuine sadness. "I have to hire someone else to ride him because I'm never home."
"He must be lonely without you," I say.
Kitty turns to me. I believe she's forgotten who I am. I have an urge to push her backward onto the grass, and I do. "Hey!" my subject cries, her voice muffled and startled, but not yet frightened exactly. "Pretend you're riding Nixon," I say. "Hey!" she yells, and I cover her mouth with my hand. Kitty is writhing beneath me, but her writhing is stymied by my height, 6'3", and my weight, 260 pounds, approximately one-third of which is concentrated in my spare tire of a, Janet Green during our last failed sexual encounter, gut, which pinions her like a sandbag. I hold her mouth with one hand and worm the other hand between our two flailing bodies until finally, yes, I manage to seize hold of my zipper. How is all this affecting me? Well, we're lying on a hill in Central Park,
a somewhat secluded spot that is still, technically speaking, in plain sight. So I feel anxious, dully aware that I'm placing my career and reputation at some risk with this caper. But more than that, I feel this crazy, what, rage it must be. What else could account for my longing to slit Kitty open like a fish and let her guts slip out, or my separate, corollary desire to break her in half and plunge my arms into whatever pure, perfumed liquid swirls within her? I want to rub it onto my raw, scrofulous, ibidum, parched skin in hopes that it will finally be healed. I want to fuck her, obviously, and then kill her, or possibly kill her in the act of fucking her. Fuck her to death, and fuck her brains out, being acceptable variations on this basic goal. What I have no interest in doing is killing her and then fucking her, because it's her life, the inner life of Kitty Jackson, that I so desperately long to reach. As it turns out, I do neither. Let us return to the moment, one hand covering Kitty's mouth and doing its best to anchor her rather spirited head, the other fumbling with my zipper, which I'm having some trouble depressing, possibly because of the writhing motions of my subject beneath me. What I have no control over, unfortunately, are Kitty's hands, one of which has found its way into her white purse, where a number of items are sequestered. A picture of a horse, a potato chip-sized cell phone, which has been ringing non-stop for the past several minutes, and a canister of something that I'd have to surmise is mace, or perhaps some form of tear gas, judging by its impact when sprayed directly into my face. A hot, blinding sensation in my eye area, accompanied by gushing tears, a strangling sensation in my throat, spastic choking, and severe nausea, all of which prompt me to leap to my feet and double over in a swoon of agony, still pinning Kitty to the ground with one foot, at which point she avails herself of yet another item in said purse. A set of keys with a small Swiss Army knife attached, whose diminutive and rather dull blade she nevertheless manages to sink through my khakis and into my calf. By now, I'm bellowing and honking like a besieged buffalo, and Kitty is running away, her tawny limbs no doubt dappled with light falling through the trees, though I'm too distressed even to look. I think I'd have to call that the end of our lunch. I got 20 extra minutes. Easy. The end of lunch, yes, but the beginning of so much else. A presentation before the grand jury, followed by my indictment for attempted rape, kidnapping, and aggravated assault. My present incarceration, despite the heroic efforts of Atticus Levi to raise my $500,000 bail, and impending trial, which is to begin this month, on the very day, as luck would have it, that Kitty's new movie, Whip Poor Will Falls, opens nationally. Kitty sent me a letter in jail. "I apologize for whatever part I played in your emotional breakdown," she wrote, "and also for stabbing you." There was a circle over each eye and a smiley face at the end. What did I tell you? Nice. Of course, our little contretemps has been enormously helpful to Kitty. Front page headlines, followed by a flurry of hand-wringing follow-up articles, editorials, and op-ed pieces addressing an array of related topics. The increasing vulnerability of celebrities, the New York Times. The violent inability of some men to cope with the feelings of rejection, USA Today.
The imperative that magazine editors vet their freelance writers more thoroughly, the New Republic, and the lack of adequate daytime security in Central Park. Footnote 4. To the editor. In the earnest spirit of your recent editorial, Vulnerability in Our Public Spaces, August 9th, and as the embodiment, if you will, of the mentally unstable or otherwise threatening people you so yearn to eradicate from the public domain in the wake of my brutal attack on that too trusting young star, allow me to make a suggestion that is sure to appeal to Mayor Giuliani at the very least. Why not simply erect checkpoints at the entrances to Central Park and demand identification from those who wish to enter? Then, you will be able to call up their records and evaluate the relative success or failure of their lives, marriage or lack thereof, children or lack thereof, professional success or lack thereof, healthy bank account or lack thereof, contact with childhood friends or lack thereof, ability to sleep peacefully at night or lack thereof, fulfillment of sprawling, loopy youthful ambitions or lack thereof, ability to fight off bouts of terror and despair or lack thereof, and using these facts, you can assign each person a ranking based on the likelihood that their personal failures will occasion jealous explosions directed at those more accomplished. The rest is easy. Simply encode each person's ranking into an electronic bracelet and affix it to their wrist as they enter the park, and then monitor those encoded points of light on a radar screen with personnel at the ready to intervene should the perambulations of low-ranking, non-famous people begin to encroach upon the safety and peace of mind that celebrities deserve as much as anyone else. I ask only this, that in keeping with our hallowed cultural tradition, you rank infamy equally with fame, so that when my public excoriation is complete, when the Vanity Fair reporter I entertained in prison 2 days ago, following her interviews with my chiropractor and building superintendent, has done her worst along with the TV news magazines, when my trial and sentence are concluded and I'm allowed at last to return to the world to stand beneath a public tree and touch its scraggly bark, then I, like Kitty, will be afforded some protection. Who knows? I might even glimpse her one day as we both promenade in Central Park. I doubt we would actually speak. I'd prefer to stand at a distance next time and wave. Respectfully, Jules Jones. End of footnote. Kitty, the martyrish figurehead of this juggernaut, is already being touted as the Marilyn Monroe of her generation, and she isn't even dead. Her new movie looks to be a hit, whatever it's about.
Chapter 10. Out of Body. Your friends are pretending to be all kinds of stuff, and your special job is to call them on it. Drew says he's going straight to law school. After practicing a while, he'll run for state senator, then U.S. senator, eventually president. He lays all this out the way you'd say, after modern Chinese painting, I'll go to the gym, then work in bops until dinner, if you even made plans anymore, which you don't, if you were even in school anymore, which you aren't, although that's supposedly temporary. You look at Drew through layers of harsh smoke floating in the sun. He's leaning back on the futon couch, his arm around Sasha. He's got a big,
Hey, come on in, face and a head of dark hair, and he's built. Not with weight room muscle like yours, but in a basic animal way that must come from all that swimming he does.
Just don't try and say you didn't inhale, you tell him.
Everyone laughs, except Bix, who's at his computer, and you feel like a funny guy for maybe half a second, until it occurs to you that they probably only laughed because they could see you were trying to be funny, and they're afraid you'll jump out the window onto East 7th Street if you fail, even at something so small. Drew takes a long hit. You hear the smoke creak in his chest. He hands the pipe to Sasha, who passes it to Lizzie, without smoking any.
I promise, Rob, Drew croaks at you, holding in smoke. If anyone asks, I'll tell them the hash I smoked with Robert Freeman Jr. was excellent.
Was that Jr. mocking? The hash is not working out as planned. You're just as paranoid as Withpot. You decide no. Drew doesn't mock. Drew is a believer. Last fall, he was one of the diehards passing out leaflets in Washington Square and registering students to vote. After he and Sasha got together, you started helping him, mostly with the jocks, because you know how to talk to them. Coach Freeman, aka your pop, calls Drew's type woodsy. They're loners, Pop says, skiers, woodchoppers, not team players. But you know all about teams. You can talk to people on teams. Only Sasha knows you picked NYU because it hasn't had a football team in 30 years. On your best day, you registered 12 team-playing Democrats, prompting Drew to exclaim when you gave him the paperwork.
You've got the touch, Rob!
But you never registered yourself. That was the thing. And the longer you waited, the more ashamed of this you got. Then it was too late. Even Sasha, who knows all your secrets, has no idea that you never cast a vote for Bill Clinton. Drew leans over and gives Sasha a wet kiss, and you can tell the hash is getting him horny because you feel it too. It makes your teeth ache in a way that will only let up if you hit someone or get hit. In high school, you'd get in fights when you felt like this, but no one will fight with you now. The fact that you hacked open your wrists with a box cutter 3 months ago and nearly bled to death seems to be a deterrent. It functions like a force field, paralyzing everyone in range with an encouraging smile on their lips. You want to hold up a mirror and ask, how exactly are those smiles supposed to help me? No one smokes hash and becomes president, Drew, you say. It'll never happen.
This is my period of youthful experimentation, he says, with an earnestness that would be laughable in a person who wasn't from Wisconsin. Besides, he says, who's gonna tell them?
I am, you say.
I love you too, Rob,
Drew says, laughing. Who said I loved you? You almost ask. Drew lifts Sasha's hair and twists it into a rope. He kisses the skin under her jaw. You stand up, seething. Bix and Lizzie's apartment is tiny, like a dollhouse, full of plants and the smell of plants, wet and planty, because Lizzie loves plants. The walls are covered with Bix's collection of Last Judgment posters, naked, babyish humans getting separated into good and bad. The good ones rising into green fields and golden light, the bad ones vanishing into mouths of monsters. The window is wide open, and you climb onto the fire escape. The March cold crackles your sinuses. Sasha joins you on the fire escape a second later. What are you doing? She asks. Don't know, you say. Fresh air. You wonder how long you can go on speaking in two-word sentences. Nice day. Across East 7th Street, two old ladies have folded bath towels on their windowsills and are resting their elbows on them while they peer down at the street below. Look there, you say, pointing. Two spies. It makes me nervous, Bobby, Sasha says. You out here.
She's the only one who gets to call you that. You were Bobby until you were 10, but according to your pop, it's a girl's name after that.
How come? You say,
third floor, broken arm or leg, worst case.
Please come in.
Relax, Sash. You park yourself on the grill steps leading up to the fourth floor windows.
Party migrate out here?
Drew origamis himself through the living room window onto the fire escape and leans over the railing to look down at the street. From inside, you hear Lizzie answer the phone.
Hi, Mom!
Trying to fluff the hash out of her voice. Her parents are visiting from Texas, which means that Bix, who's black, is spending his nights in the electrical engineering lab where he's doing his PhD research. Lizzie's parents aren't even staying with her. They're at a hotel. But if Lizzie is sleeping with a black man in the same city where her parents are, they will just know. Lizzie pokes her torso out the window. She's wearing a tiny blue skirt and tan patent leather boots that go up higher than her knees. To herself, she's already a costume designer. How's the bigot? You ask, realizing with chagrin that the sentence has three words. Lizzie turns to you, flushed.
Are you referring to my mother?
Not me.
You can't talk that way in my apartment, Rob,
she says, using the calm voice they've all been using since you got back from Florida, a voice that leaves you no choice but to test how hard you have to push before it cracks. I'm not, you indicate the fire escape.
Or on my fire escape.
Not yours, you correct her. Bix's, too. Actually, no. The city's.
Fuck you, Rob,
Lizzie says. You too, you say, grinning with satisfaction at the sight of real anger on a human face. It's been a while. Calm down, Sasha tells Lizzie.
Excuse me, I should calm down?
Lizzie says.
He's been a total asshole ever since he got back.
He's only been back 2 weeks, Sasha says. I love how they talk about me like I'm not here, you observe to Drew. Do they think I'm dead?
They think you're stoned.
They're correct.
Me too.
Drew climbs the fire escape until he's a few stairs above you and perches there. He takes a long breath, savoring it, and you take one too. In Wisconsin, Drew has shot an elk with a bow and arrow, skinned it, cut off the meat into sections, and carried it home in a backpack, wearing snowshoes. Or maybe he was kidding. He and his brothers built a log cabin with their bare hands